Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Book Podcast. I'm Deidre Tyler, host. Today, we will be talking with Naomi Calhoun. She's not going to be here, but June Carbone and Nancy Leavitt. They are the authors of Fair Shake, Women and the Fight to Build a Just Economy. How are you doing today?
Fine, thanks. Delighted to be here.
I wonder if you could start by saying a few words about yourself and how you got started on this project.
Sure. Well, I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota. I have a fancy title called Robina Chair in Law, Science, and Technology. But my traditional areas are family law, including assisted reproduction. I've followed technological innovation, women, and the glass ceiling in Silicon Valley for years and years. And I have known Naomi Khan, and I have written several books together. And Nancy Leavitt and I have known each other almost since the beginning of our careers. And we decided to do this book together when we discovered our interests overlapped. Nancy?
I'm Nancy Leavitt. I'm the Associate Dean for Faculty and a Curator's Professor at the University of Missouri Kansas City School of Law. Our third, Naomi Khan, is the Justice Anthony M. Kennedy Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. And as June said, the three of us have collaborated, written a number of articles together. Naomi and June wrote very celebrated books, Red Families, Blue Families, and Marriage Markets. So we've been writing together for years. We teach and write about gender, the family, employment discrimination. We talk about gender issues quite a bit among the three of us. And we did a back of the envelope calculation and realized that women college grads were losing. And we were shocked to find that in an era of supposed gender equality, women were losing ground in the workplace. We started our research more than 6 years ago, and the overall figures seemed to show that women were ever so slowly gaining on men, wage gap was narrowing. And then we began to look at the numbers for college graduates, and we found that the gender gap in wages was increasing. There was a 2019 Goldman Sachs study. It got a lot of press for its claims that if present trends continue, women would not catch up with men in terms of wages for another 100 or so years. So that was what spawned the book.
Great. Tell us about the whistleblower at Telsler, and what can we learn from this story?
Well, we had been following Elon Musk for a while. He had all the traits that we think are the road to perdition in this book. Egomania, brilliant success, slave driver mentality in the workforce. And we wondered about women at Tesla, and then we saw Van der Meiden's story. And it had things we're seeing everywhere. First, how did she get her job? She's passionate about Tesla. She parks herself on a park bench in Palo Alto until somebody comes out of the company and then pitches herself to her employer. And they're impressed and they hire her. She's not working directly on cars. She's doing other things, but she put in a 26-hour shift. And so the boss said, hey, I want you on my team. And that idea that you reach somewhere unusual, you hire somebody with no obvious, educational qualifications. She has an impressive education, just not automotive engineering, and she becomes an automotive engineer. that story, very much like what Jack Welch bragged about at GE, what Sam Walton liked to do at Walmart. And we thought, yeah, this sounds very familiar. So she gets hired. She's putting in long hours. She's working like crazy. She really believes in Tesla. And two things happen, all kinds of sexual harassment. Now, sexual harassment in an automotive manufacturing plant with lots of pressure, not unusual. But then she goes a step farther and finds out that Tesla doesn't believe in quality control. She discovers a defect in the car she's working on. She proposes a fix, just what an engineer should do. And they ignore her. Why? Because what Elon Musk wants is to ramp up production. Unlike other people, he actually gave an interview where he admitted that he didn't care about quality control. He said, we'll fix that on the next production run. And so the story of somebody, a woman, doing really well, seems to be playing the game on the same terms as the men. Long hours, lack of credentials, that's how the men work. Doing a good job, and then she shoved aside. Why? Because she has the temerity to complain about sexual harassment, and because she points out quality flaws, something for which Tesla has become famous. So she's pushed aside. Her case results in mandatory arbitration and a non-disclosure arbitration agreement. So we can't tell you exactly what's happened. But the complaint, which details these allegations, fits all the stories about Tesla and isn't that different from every other story in our book.
Interesting. Now, tell us about the wages for men and women in the 90s regarding blue collar and college graduates. What did you find?
Sure. So Nancy had started to talk about this. And, Naomi, in my last book was called Marriage Markets, How Inequality Has Remade the American Family. And our whole argument is the way men and women match up has changed. And that led to this book, is really digging down deep on what happened. So if you look at the top of the economy, what happens in the 90s is the top wages go through the roof. CEOs start making dramatically more than average workers. You go back to the 50s, it wasn't all that big a difference from the CEO to the average employee. Now, there's an enormous difference. And if you look at the charts, it's the 90s where that takes off. Jack Welch at GE introduces competitive pay. Where you pit employees against each other, that becomes the norm across the corporate economy, is competitive pay. And with competitive pay, the top earners start getting stock options, and stock options begin to really pay off. You look at tech and finance. There's a period from the early 90s until the financial crisis where 57% of all increases in income go to finance. You look at tech, this is the dot-com era. It's also a shift from, the real innovation is now taking place at startups, not at IBM. Startups are the key. And with startups, again, you're gambling with other people's money. If you win big, which means your startup goes public and is on the stock market or is bought out by a larger company, the starters, including basic engineers, have stock options that pay off really handsomely. So what we see when we look at these numbers is that there is this huge gain across finance, tech, and the top executive positions. They're increasing dramatically. And as they do, the number of women, which had been increasing into the 90s, either declines as a percentage or flatlines. It stays about at what it had been for the next 10 years. And we found that pretty extraordinary. And when you look at blue collar jobs, there are two things going on. The first, where men used to outperform women big time is the middle of the economy. So all those blue-collar unionized jobs, when you think about the 50s, women couldn't get them. Those jobs were the middle of the economy. And blue-collar men doing, you know, what used to be unionized jobs, took a hatchet. We have offshoring, you know, sending the jobs overseas, or from unionized state in the north to the south, or outsourcing them. Janitors that work for big companies used to be unionized. Janitorial services have now been outsourced to the janitorial firm down the street. And those employees have, you know, no security, low wages, et cetera. So blue-collar men take a hit. What's happening to blue-collar women? Well, they're gaining on blue-collar men, but they used to be way behind blue-collar men. And when you look at blue-collar women, and we start our story talking about Walmart, women are disproportionately concentrated in middle class, in minimum wage jobs, and the minimum wage really didn't see much increase since the 60s. The retail economy, heavily dominated by women, squeezed. Labor suppression is the name of the game, and Walmart set the national standards for retail workers who in the 70s and 80s had been gaining a bit. And teachers. I mean, teachers are the middle of the economy. Teachers, when you look at the 90s, the high point for male teachers is in the early 90s. And in the early 90s, teachers are making about what comparably educated professionals are making with similar education in other fields. That changes. By the time we wrote the book, the gap between teachers and other workers was at an all-time high, and women were back up to 77% of teachers, the same kind of percentage as years ago. So that's what we found.
Now, you also talked about the Goldman Sachs 2019 study about the present trends. Why can you make a case to illustrate this information about women in the workplace?
Sure. And we want to make one point, and then I'm going to turn this to Nancy. One point we want to make is, you know, all the studies in Goldman Sachs is typical are that if present trends continue, it'll be another 100 years before women catch up. We think that's not true. We think if present trends continue, women will never catch up. Let me emphasize why. The real gains women have made have been at the bottom of the economy. So at the bottom of the economy, women were catching up, and there's not a whole lot more to gain. In the middle of the economy, teachers, nurses, etc., there are a whole lot more women. They're doing better than men to some degree in the middle of the economy, and they're being squeezed. One of the things about the middle of the economy, the part of the economy that is not being automated, is it doesn't exist unless it's government funded. Take education. Education, you know, the single biggest expense in most state budgets is education. And the problem with state spending is it's cyclical. Only federal spending is counter-cyclical. So you had the financial crisis. Who took the biggest hit? Teachers. Why? Because of something called the fiscal cliff. Mitch McConnell blocked funding for the states. Richard Nixon had championed revenue sharing. The federal government needs to bail out the states during a downtime. Mitch McConnell blocked it. With the so-called shellacking in 2010, but also when Trump was president and we had the COVID recession, Trump wanted more money for the states. McConnell blocked it again on ideological grounds. Teachers took a hit. The good news is that with the new administration and a new Congress, funding for states to soften the effects of the COVID recession kicked in, preventing a depression-level conditions in the states. who's affected by this? Number one is teachers. Number two is actually police officers, but because they're a tiny percentage of the number of teachers, they have a larger impact on state budgets. And then when you look at healthcare, the single biggest source of expansion of jobs in rural areas is Obamacare, keeping open rural hospitals. Women disproportionately benefit from those jobs. That requires public spending. Without Medicaid expansion, which is optional in many states, jobs for women in rural areas take a big hit. So what we see is, those are present trends. If present trends, starving the beast, and increasing the benefits that go to the top through private salaries in male-dominated fields, those trends continue. Women will lose ground going forward, not catch up.
And just to add to the top, we were so used to hearing that women had become the better educated sex and that education was key to advancement. And that is true in one sense. Women are getting the greater number of bachelor's degrees and master's degrees. And it used to be true with respect to the translation to wages. In the 1970s, 1980s, women's wages were gaining on men's, and those gains were associated with greater education. By 2000, women had become the better educated sex, and since 2006, more doctorate degrees. But it was in these groups, the ranks of college graduates as a group, the highest earners among college graduates in particular, where gender disparities had grown at the fastest rate.
Now, can we blame gender wage gap between men and women on the choices that women make?
There are a number of conventional explanations for women's lack of progress. One is women's family responsibilities. The role of family responsibilities has always explained a significant part of the wage gap. It continues to do so today. The gender pay gap for women who are age 25 to 34 is smaller than for women who are in the 35 to 54 age bracket, which is the peak child rearing years, when mothers are making different career choices than fathers to accommodate family responsibilities. The second conventional explanation is women's occupational choices, as you mentioned. But the problem with this line of thinking, of focusing on women's choices to assume family responsibilities, to pick different careers, to not lean in, is that these factors have always held women back. And they don't explain why the gendered pay gap for college grads, the group with the greatest access to quality childcare, increased after the early 90s. They also don't explain why Black women, who've long managed to a greater degree than white women to juggle work and family responsibilities, remain one of the most disadvantaged groups in society. And so those don't explain why salaries increase so rapidly in areas that were male-dominated to begin with, and yet why women's participation declined. We think it's that these areas got more hostile to women from the 1990s, at least through our data is through 2016.
Yes, and can I jump in on this? It leads into our triple bind, which we talk about in the book. One of the things we emphasize is when you talk about the choices women make, they're rational. That is, if you look at the statistics on who succeeds, so you've got to put in a whole lot more time. Go back to 1960. People who worked more than 40 hours a week made less per hour than people who worked more than 40 hours a week. Today, the opposite is true. You want these jobs we described that have grown exponentially in pay. You got to put in long hours. But, and if you don't, you're really out of the running. That's the mommy track. But if you put in the long hours, take law firm partners, the average law firm equity partner makes something like close to $1 million a year, but the average woman equity partner makes something like $600,000 a year. To get to where she is, she's got to put in the long hours too, probably as long as the guy. But if she does, the payoff is less, substantially less. So we describe this in terms of a triple bind. If you're not playing by the rules, and the rules are often hidden, that's what happened to Betty Dukes at Walmart. She didn't find out until she was part of this nationwide class action that what Walmart was really about is not what she thought it was about. The second thing is, if you do play by the same rules, women are more likely to be pushed out. Van der Weyden is a very nice example of that. She was aggressive. She was putting in the hours. Discovering product safety defects or product quality defects that no one else had found, and figuring out and designing a fix and pushing really hard to get your ideas adopted by the company, that's what the guys pride themselves on doing. That's a good reason why she was fired. And women, the third part of our triple bind, what we add to the classic double bind, is if women figure out that's what's going on, a lot of them either figure, hey, this is not worth it. I don't want to be the person who's going to lose. Or it's, I don't want to be part of that game. So what you see in a number of places, and we're happy to talk about finance, which is the worst and some of the best documented excesses, is if women realize what you have to do is cook the books, fleece your customers, do things that are illegal that could end you up in jail, women are more likely to say no. But they're also more likely to be the person who goes to jail. And if you figure that out, you don't want to play on those terms. And so a large part of what we tried to describe is not just these private sector salaries at the top have increased exponentially and they're not hiring women, but the system that produces them is one that rewards the people who can break the rules and get away with it. And that group is disproportionately male because the getting away with it part is a critical part of the new world.
Now, I also want to know what happens when women complain.
Nancy, you want to go for that?
Sure. One of the things that we have noticed and supported by significant research is that when women complain, they are punished. Mark Egan, who's a Harvard economist, did a wonderful study called When Harry Fired Sally. And it compared the outcomes when women were investigated for misconduct, women were disproportionately terminated for misconduct, even if they didn't commit misconduct as serious as did men. And when women complain about difficulties they have seen in the workforce, when they complain about sexual harassment, when they complain about sex discrimination, they are punished much more harshly, and they're punished for sharp elbows, for acting unconventionally for their gender. They're punished for the complaints. And the interesting thing is the punishment for complaining goes sort of subterranean, right? Because if there are these structures that June has been describing that are reward systems, and if women are not working the very longest hours, or if women are not living up to the boss's expectations for short-term reductionist metrics, the companies think they have essentially a market defense. Oh, this employee isn't as good as others. And so what we're seeing is this combination of women experiencing harassment and discrimination when they complain about it, they're really complaining in essence about a hyper-competitive system, but it's the system itself that's the defense. June, did you want to tell the story of Guitron, Wells Fargo?
Yes. Yeah. There's just a classic story. So Wells Fargo, now nationally famous for its fake account scandal, enormous pressure on employees to meet quotas to open new accounts. And it it had a slogan, eight is great. If the same family has eight accounts instead of one account, they become stickier, less likely to switch banks if Wells Fargo offers less competitive rates on accounts, on credit cards, on pet insurance. The goal at Wells Fargo is to get your clients to open as many different accounts in as many different products Wells Fargo offers as possible. So the pressure was so great that employees basically said you couldn't meet the quotas without opening fake accounts. And in 2011, this is before the scandal breaks nationally, Guitron, who's in California, complains. She rats out her fellow employees. They're opening fake accounts. She's saying, you know, I can't really do this without engaging in fraud, and tries to bring this to the attention of her supervisors. So what happens? She starts being dinged. She arrives a couple minutes late. Everybody arrives a couple minutes late. No big deal, except for her. And, you know, she tries, you know, she's eventually fired. She tries filing for whistleblower protection and sex discrimination. Some of this involves being late because of child care issues, et cetera. And she loses. And the court goes up on, the case goes up on appeal. And a California appellate court in 2015, after the scandal is broken, says, but she didn't meet her quotas. They had reason to fire her. The quotas couldn't be met without opening fake accounts. And so we see a lot of cases like that. We talked to Mark Egan about this study. And one of the things he said to us is when an employee is fired for misconduct, even if it's trivial misconduct, even if it's invented misconduct, when she's really being fired for retaliation for complaining, the retaliation is illegal. I mean, if you're being fired because you complained about sex discrimination, you were a whistleblower, that's illegal. But if they fired you because you were 2 minutes late or because you didn't open enough accounts when the only way you could do it by opening fake accounts, then the courts say, oh, that person committed misconduct. Of course, we're not going to second guess that. And so it's part of the system that covers up what's taking place.
WTO, winner takes all. Describe that to the audience. What's your meaning? What's the meaning of that?
We use the term winner take all or WTA economy to describe a critical shift in the new economy as the ability of those at the top to take a much larger share of institutional resources for themselves. And it's a new economy that crosses job sectors, and it explains the patterns that had stumped us. The winner-take-all era, as June said earlier, started with the increase in CEO compensation. It rose a whopping 514% in the 30 years between 2020. And that means that back in the 50s, back in the 60s, CEO to worker pay was at about a 20-to-1 ratio. Today, it is a mind-blowing 399-to-1 ratio. Successful CEOs, in turn, began to reward their top lieutenants and managers and key employees with bonuses and stock options that could make those who succeeded very wealthy and substantially better paid than other employees. And those bonuses were typically tied to short-term reductionist metrics such as sales or earnings or the production of Teslas. And those profoundly changed corporate cultures. Workplaces where there are increased rewards for those at the top are the same workplaces that pit employees against each other. And practices like these are linked to increasing gender disparities, and they keep everybody insecure. So if the manager is rewarding the person who opens the most fake accounts, or if the lieutenant is rewarding those who are making their employees commit wage and hour violations by not recording all the time that they to which they should be entitled to wages, then those are zero-sum games. The employees are playing zero-sum games with, of course, negative-sum consequences. What we noticed was men will typically compete at work, and men are competing for dominance. Men are displaying endurance or strength or the ability to work longer hours. And remember, women are the ones with greater family responsibilities. Engagement in cutthroat competition. Those environments have been shown to produce sexist climates, and climates where women experience hostility, where women experience patronizing behavior, where women experience harassment, intimidation, bullying, and where all employees are experiencing higher burnout, higher rates of illness, higher rates of depression. Women aren't able to win in that new game, but we tend to see, and we can talk about this, women as one of the best hopes to fight against it.
Now, you talk about the gig economy in your book. How are women at risk in this new gig economy?
Go ahead, Nancy.
Sure. The gig economy has pluses and minuses, right? Pros and cons. Women who might otherwise be home full-time with kids might find this a way to be in the economy at all, or to be in the economy at hours that are convenient. Men who do this generally have other jobs. So their reservation price is higher. They don't have to do the gig unless it pays near to what their other job might pay. And there's an underlying backdrop for the disparities. But then if we think about the substance of gig work comes with an absence of insurance. There aren't any HR controls. To whom does one report sexual harassment? There's nobody to sue. And very insidiously, apps will serve to atomize workers. They will pit the workers against each other in competition for jobs. And so women and men engaging in gig labor will have fundamentally different experiences and the absence of any impulse to take collective action.
Now, does the tech economy push women out?
Yes, let me talk about that. So, you know, the thing that runs through this whole description is really a description of a system. Pit employees against each other. The person at the top, take Elon Musk, starting Tesla, incredibly innovative car, designed to disrupt the automobile industry. But what he's really going to do is ramp up production incredibly fast. And when you look at how he runs his factories, it's who can get me these cars on the road in the shortest amount of time possible. Securities fraud, he's been endlessly investigated by the SEC, had to pay $20 million, and then just went back doing it again. Had to pay $20 million personally in fines and was booted out as chairman of the board, but got to stay on as CEO of Tesla and just did it again. When you look at, again, the product issues, incredible number of recalls at Tesla. Does he care? No. Because there's a period of time in which, in the same time period, several hundred thousand Teslas were recalled in the following week. He announced he had exceeded production. And what took place was The stock market rewarded this by making him the richest man in the world. This is within 2 weeks of each other, okay? So when you look at then startups, it's even worse. Nancy described, if you don't have any rules, you don't have HR, it's whatever you get away with. Well, that's startup world. So startups typically start out as a handful of people, and then they grow very quickly. Uber, we have a chapter on Uber in the book. I mean, that's just a whole story in itself, because what you've got taking place is sexual harassment is rampant. The guys putting in long hours, the guys sometimes compete to get the right women on their teams. Uber tried to increase diversity. It hired a number of women and racial minorities out of coding boot camps. And because it was so eager to increase diversity, it was 20% women software engineers at one point, a very high percentage. By the time of the investigation, it had fallen 7%. So what's driving women out? Again, not the long hours. Studies of Silicon Valley indicate that it's not the hours, because the engineers, the people in startups in general, tend to be pretty young, don't yet have kids. That's not what drives them out. It's abusive bosses. And the studies we looked at, Uber, again, kind of like Tesla, it's you got to grow massively very, very quickly. That's startup culture. And in Uber's case, what you're doing is you move into an area, you grow, you have customer loyalty. And then when the taxi companies say everything you're doing is illegal, which it typically is, it's violating all the taxi regulations, then you get the regulations changed because your loyal customer base threatens to vote the people out of office who don't let Uber into the area. That's the name of the game. Now, who do you hire when you're interested in that? Again, lovely psychological studies, people with over-optimism bias, that is, narcissism. There are no downsides. I can do it. People who are amoral, who are willing to lie and cheat and steal. You find when you create an environment like that, alliances, having the right mentor who will protect you, incredibly important. And who do mentors look for and protect? People whose behavior they can predict. They dangle carrots, big bonuses. They see who jumps highest, who will break the rules without being asked to break the rules, who will not, rat out the boss when the investigation occurs. And how do you predict such behavior? You pick people you see as thinking like you, acting like you, looking like you. High-pressure companies like this, diversity of all kinds decreases, but more critically, the people who become bosses, these are called masculinity contest cultures, and it turns out the type of people who thrive in such environments think they're entitled to sexually harass. They get their bennies out of harassing employees they see as weaker, including men who aren't macho. It becomes like a gang. If you think of a criminal gang with alpha males who patrol a fiefdom, that's what such environments become. And they almost inevitably drive out women, because women aren't one of the guys, and the women who try too hard to be one of the guys are often disliked for doing so, the way Vandermeiden was at Tesla. And so startups, especially high-pressure startups, tend to produce this kind of environment. A whole lot of young men working long hours. Uber had an open beer keg on the premises. A lot of startups, substance abuse is rampant, and all of that produces bad behavior and rewards bad behavior.
In Chapter 7, you talk about a dental couple doing their pandemic environment. Can you tell us about that story?
Sure. The chapter is entitled Home Alone. We interviewed a woman who was an assistant office manager for a dental practice. And during the pandemic, with schools and daycare shuttered, she and her husband made the very difficult decision to leave their baby home with their 14-year-old who was doing school remotely. And when the 14-year-old became ill, the manager asked to work from home for a few days to arrange care. Hers was a phone job. And the office manager said no. It was a private equity firm, Aspen Dental, a dental services organization that managed the HR aspects of dental practices for individual providers, including the practice where she worked. And there has been this move toward private equity holdings with people having no personal relationships with the folks they are managing, a relationship that would have likely said, sure, take a few days. You've got two children, one is a baby, and it's the pandemic, and we've got ill kids. Let's let you figure out the childcare. She filed suit arguing that Aspen Dental had interfered with her rights under the Family and Medical Leave Act, and she alleged her employer retaliated against her when she tried to invoke her rights to reinstatement under another, which is another violation of the FMLA. But the important picture, if you step back and look at the big screen, is the private equity playbook has really transformed the healthcare sector. And it brings with it this winner-take-all worldview that's really out of step with the needs of healthcare providers and also with patients. There are mortality studies from the University of Pennsylvania and Chicago Booth and NYU, and they examined private equity owned nursing homes over a 15-year period. And they found that the profit goals led to reduced staffing, and providing basic hygiene or infection management or monitoring or an increase in antipsychotic medications administered in these homes. And these differences led to a 10% increase in mortality rates. So Aspen Dental was just such a private equity company. And we've seen the pernicious effects of these remote players who don't understand the workplaces and who care very little for the workers, let alone the clients.
Are women used as scapegoats? Tell us about the story of Melissa. How did she fight back?
Well, actually, Melissa Tomlinson, our teacher, that's actually fascinating. So, you know, if you look at teachers are, you know, I like to joke, the last two groups left in American society that represent feminine values are school teachers and the military. What do I mean by that? Obviously, when the military goes off and fights wars, it's not reflecting feminist values, and definitely not feminist. But on the feminine side, if you think of you're motivated by honor, concern for others, camaraderie, you care for the person in the foxhole next to you, you value living up to the goals of your profession. You see teachers as there to help kids, to be pillars of their community. And what you see, and what Melissa Tomlinson fought about, is Chris Christie became governor of New Jersey in 2011. This is the height of the financial crisis. Mitch McConnell is about to engineer the fiscal cliff. Christie wins because he attacks his predecessor as governor of New Jersey for raising taxes. He's not going to raise taxes. But it's one of the biggest budget shortfalls in New Jersey history. And the only thing he can't cut is education. So what does he do? He attacks teachers. He makes teachers the scapegoats. He refers to public schools in Trenton and Newark, poor, heavily black cities, as failure factories. And Melissa Tomlinson, who's in not a wealthy school district, but not a city, not an urban school district, she decides to confront Christie. So she goes to one of his rallies and she says to him, "Why are you calling teachers failures? Why are you calling public schools failure faculty? It's not true." And he wags a finger. It is an iconic picture, goes viral. He wags his finger in her face, and his supporters start jeering her. It took an enormous amount of courage to confront Christie. But her point was, look, there's a budget shortfall that finance engineered, and New Jersey schools are hurting because somebody cut the federal budget in the middle of one of the biggest recessions in U.S. history, a really dumb thing to do economically. And Christie is trying to make scapegoats of teachers at a time when teacher salaries are not competitive with the private sector, and when teachers do it because of the love of kids, and he's trying to make them look greedy and incompetent. And she describes how all of the so-called reforms, things like high-stakes testing, make the teacher's job worse. You spend all this time doing paperwork instead of helping kids. At Tesla, the ideal is you get a group of engineers together to fix the product quality defects. At schools, teachers get together to try to figure out how to reach a higher percentage of kids. But instead, they're spending their time on these tests. And what did the Obama administration present as a solution? Well, Arne Duncan, when he was Secretary of Education, what he wanted was competitive pay for teachers. And it turns out that when you get competitive pay, one of the things that happens is the people most attracted to competitive teaching are men. The most experienced and successful teachers leave for private schools. And it changes the atmosphere in ways that emphasize bottom line test results and cheating. Cheating on the test, cheating by the teachers, looking the other way at students who make you look better by bringing in material, etc. And that's not what education's about. So Melissa Tomlinson is one of our heroes for her willingness to stand up to Chris Christie.
And if I can just build on that to address your question, Deidre, of fighting back, there's another example of fighting back that is writ large, and we discuss it in the book, and I would imagine every listener is familiar with it, and that is the Me Too movement. For really centuries, women suffered indignities and assaults in silence. In 2017, actor Alyssa Milano tweeted a term that it was a term that actually activist Tarana Burke had developed in 2006, hashtag Me Too. Within a year, there were 19 million hashtag Me Too tweets. And it was people telling their stories, sometimes in excruciating detail. It was a call for action. It was a call for accountability rather than a source of shame. And Me Too involved turning the tables on those who have used the accumulation of power to ensure their own invulnerability. So Me Too served as a form of jujitsu, turning the power of celebrated men to act with impunity into a weapon against them, using their very celebrity to topple them. Me Too had a stunning impact. In 2018, the New York Times documented over 200 men who had been brought down by reports of misconduct, many of whom were then replaced by women. And some cynics saw this advancement of women during a time of crisis as just window dressing. But the promotion of women to positions of power tends not only to reduce the incidence of harassment, but also to encourage the adoption of other sorts of pro-social policies, leading to better employee-employer relationships, greater attention to employee health and safety, improved management of diversity challenges. And So this fighting back, and it wasn't just against egregious sexual predators like Weinstein, but against the everyday harassment that marginalizes women's place in the workforce, this had a number of incredible impacts, including the idea that sunlight on these abuses is one of the best disinfectants.
Now, coming to the Me Too movement, you gave another example of Marilyn Perez, undocumented immigrant from Guatemala. What happened here?
Nancy, do you want to take that?
You may all know that that there was Time Magazine did an article, and it listed the person of the year. I think it was 2017. And Time Magazine named the Silence Breakers its person of the year. And included were celebrities Taylor Swift, Ashley Judd, I think a lobbyist, Adama Iwu, and a farm worker who wasn't so different from Marilyn Perez. Well, Marilyn Perez was an undocumented immigrant from Guatemala. She harvested vegetables in Florida. There was a profile of her in the Atlantic, and her crew chief put together crews that consisted almost entirely of recent undocumented immigrants. And the crew chief forced the workers to put in 10 to 12 hour days and picking produce, working nights at a packing house, limiting their access to food and water. They were even sold drinks and meals at increased prices. And Perez protested that she should be receiving full pay and not having the crew boss taking out money for rent and transportation. And after her additional requests for full pay, the crew boss suggested he might pay her more if she had sex with him. And she refused. And he caught her alone in an isolated area. He grabbed her. He fondled her. Her story is a story that we've seen over and over. And there have been some activities and making public that made public these stories. Perez, when her story became public, was connected with the coalition of Imokalee workers. I'm going to mispronounce it. Imokalee, Imokalee workers. It was a farm workers' rights organization that helped her and other workers in her camp find a lawyer. And she won a damage award, a significant amount of money, I think in the hundreds of thousands, from her crew boss. And so again, what are we seeing? We're seeing collective action. We are seeing the sunlight, and we're seeing some sorts of reckoning on a big picture scale.
Now, you talk about at the conclusion, women in politics. What are some of the recommendations that you have for this new economy?
So this is actually one of the more interesting developments we're seeing on a global basis. The Economist did a recent chart looking at gender differences in political views. Do you lean liberal or conservative? And finding huge differences across, you know, one of the biggest is in South Korea, but the U.S. is pretty up there. And the gender gap in voting has been growing. It's, you know, last couple of elections, somewhere between 5 to 9%. But the gender gap in attitudes is dramatically greater. If you ask, men should be men and women should be women, and we need to promote traditional values associated with masculinity, you get a 50% difference between Republicans and Democrats. If you ask questions about helping, you know, we should help every member of society, you also see a big gender difference on policies associated with helping the poor, lifting the floor, things like that. So what we say about it and what we recommend in terms of politics, again, is you have to see this as a question. How do you build a coalition that promotes collective values? One of what drives, and one of the big partisan splits right now is men tend to be somewhat more driven by status and grievance. They are more likely to, if you answer a question, if somebody, some people can be really, really rich, but more people are going to be poor. Is that okay? Men are more likely to say yes to that. But they're also more likely to be driven by a perception they're losing. So, you know, we have lots of people and we have conversations among ourselves. Can we say nice things about the 50s, the racist, sexist 50s? I remember the 50s. One of the things, mistakes I think we do make politically is not asking the question, why were the way things happened in the 50s so different? And I think you have to say, look, the Roosevelt Coalition from 1940, roughly, you know, started petering out in the 70s, did some truly remarkable things. First, Franklin Roosevelt created a foundation for greater equality. When you look at the best periods for African Americans, it was the 40s. And the 40s, not just because of the war, hiring blacks in defense plants, but because Roosevelt made a point of promoting unionization by locating defense plants in pro-union states. And one of the things you see is the workers who got good union jobs who couldn't have gotten them, the unions tended to protect them afterwards. Non-union workers who had come up from the South were laid off when the white troops came home. And that laid the foundation for the civil rights movement, with the UAW, for example, which had a lot of black workers, being strongly in favor of civil rights. But women's protection came along with a greater equality in general. When you had greater economic equality, you also have people who feel, I'm doing okay, I can afford to let more people in the door. So the big push in protection for women came in the 60s, in a relatively prosperous time period. And I would add the other great decade for blacks, for both men and women, is in the South from 1965 to 1975. And it's a variation on the same story. The South was booming economically, and the price was paying some attention to civil rights. And you had a win-win set of mindset. I think you have to do the following things that you saw in the 60s. The other key to the 50s and 60s, the whole period from 1940 well into the 60s is a period of 80 to 90% marginal tax rates. Now, I will tell you, when I tell people that, especially in corporate environments, they look at me like I'm a radical in the same league with AOC, who has proposed such things. But it turns out that when you have relative economic equality and high marginal tax rates, the bragging rights of the 50s organization man was, my company is bigger than your company. My company has Bell Labs and is more prestigious than your company. I like to compare George Romney, who ran for president in the 60s, having been president of American Motors and then governor of Michigan, with his son Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney's bragging rights when he ran for president in 2012 were, how much money did he have in the Cayman Islands in his personal bank account? George Romney's bragging rights were the health of American Motors. When you cap the top and have relative equality, you invest more in institutions instead of who can rip off institutions, our winner-take-all model. And you also have more support for people being left behind. When you look at women as a group, precisely because women can't win the rig game, women tend to provide a whole lot more support for relatively more equal policies and for the rule of law. What we describe as the winner-take-all economy, when you look at Walmart, when you look at GE, when you look at Tesla, it's breaking the rules. It's all three companies literally broke the law. Walmart, number one in wage theft in the country. Number two is Home Depot, and it's, you know, hundreds of millions more by Walmart. its success is built on the ability to defy wages and hours regulations and get away with it. That's the real story of Betty Dukes. Same thing at GE, same thing at Tesla. Women, because they can't get away with it, tend to be a force for collective action, rule of law. We're all in this together, transparent workplaces. NASDAQ has found that when you increase the number of women on boards, you get less securities fraud. You get fewer mistakes that require revised accounting statements. BlackRock, the huge trillion-dollar investment company, has discovered greater diversity of all kinds tends to produce greater management regularity. There's a lot of cynicism right now about, quote, woke investing, end quote. But corporate America recognizes that greater diversity is associated with following the rules, being transparent, caring about morale. And there's evidence, though the economists tell me you can't prove anything, that it's associated with greater productivity, greater investment in workers, greater more emphasis on training and retaining workers rather than squeezing workers in a way that inevitably produces high turnover and lower morale. So what we see when we look at this is if you had greater equality, you also get greater ability to enforce the law for everyone, not just the little people. And if you get, you know, what you're seeing right now in low wage industries like restaurants and a number of companies that are now it's hard to hire, you have tighter labor markets. When you get that, you invest more in the workers you have. All of these things disproportionately benefit women. And so what we would like to see is a more equal society devoted to the rule of law. And we see women as one of the forces behind it, in part because women can't win the rig game. They then therefore tend to be more likely to support the honest game.
Well, I've taken up enough of your time. Can you tell us the next project you'll be working on?
Well, we have a number. We have one talking about, is the U.S. about to engage in legal civil war? We have another that talks about gender. So if you take what we're talking about, and one of our findings from the book that's kind of fun, so we went back and looked at the Organization Man of the 50s. So William White wrote this screed attacking the Organization Man, and John Kenneth Galbraith wrote the defense of the Organization Man. John Kenneth Galbraith, the highest point of corporate America in the 50s is the technocracy, rule by committee, the superior form of management. And he was much lampooned for it. But when we looked at it, we saw, oh, White and Galbraith are describing the same thing. They're describing the Organization Man of the 50s could have been a woman. And White's preferred executive could be described in terms of toxic masculinity. But nobody ever talked about those in gender terms. And we'd like to suggest we have a new project that's going to talk about, you know, you want to talk about Nietzsche and the will to power, the authoritarian personality and what was wrong with fascism in the 30s, Hobbesian universes. It turns out these things are deeply gendered. And Carol Gilligan wrote about this long ago, and she said, I want to revalue the traditionally feminine. And we're going to argue, hey, you don't have to revalue it. It turns out it is often highly valued when it's associated with men. And we see the fight that's coming is one not between men and women per se, but between what has historically been seen as alpha maledom versus what you could call feminine values, but could also be called community decency and the rule of law.
Well, we'll be looking forward to those projects. And thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much for the conversation. We really appreciate it.
Yes, very much.